So welcome, everyone, to the monthly action call for March 2016. As you know, my name is Dan Kahn, and I'm the National Field Director for the Peace Alliance, and I'm thrilled to welcome you all to this call. Before we dive into our agenda, I'd like to reflect briefly on the nature of our intentions and our work here together. On one of our calls a little over a year ago, Elizabeth Kucinich, the wife of former Congressman Dennis Kucinich, described this work, the work of peacebuilding, as making practical the aspiration to live in harmony with each other. I'll say that again, making practical the aspiration to live in harmony with each other. So peace on earth may not seem like a particularly easy or humble goal, but as probably all of you know, it often happens bit by bit, conversation by conversation, sometimes program by program, champion by champion, and sometimes in very simple ways, like sharing grief or joy or a mindful breath. So I'd like to thank you all again for coming together on this call to cooperate on this really vast yet simple project. Here is our agenda for the next 58 minutes or so. In a few minutes, I'll introduce our special guest, Daniel Sullivan, and he'll share, and then we'll have a chance for discussion with him. And after that, we'll have a few announcements. We'll hear about grassroots victories from the field, and then we'll have coaching on the March Monthly Action. And the March Monthly Action is to write a letter to the editor in support of the Genocide and Atrocities Prevention Act. So it might help if you have internet access during the second half of this call to download the action sheet, if you haven't already done that, and also to look online at a local newspaper, unless you have a hard copy handy, to get ideas about the letter that you may start to write. I want to remind you, when you listen to our special guest tonight, I hope you'll be listening for that piece of inspiration, those bits of information that fire you up a little, that might help you generate some powerful action. We'll be looking together at the March action sheet in about 30 minutes. So please have that available, and if you don't yet have it, you can download it from the monthly action page on our website. Before I introduce Daniel Sullivan, let me tell him a little bit about the folks who are on the call tonight. Dan, the folks on this call tend to see peacebuilding needs and opportunities from the very personal and local level to the international and global one. And many of these folks have been actively developing relationships with peacebuilders in their communities to learn about and support their work, and also with the professional media to publicize the importance of peacebuilding work, and also with their members of Congress to change federal policy to help this work to proliferate. So these are folks, for example, like Deborah Walters in Champaign County, Ohio, who happens to be on the call, who has gotten two letters and one short essay published just this past year in support of the Youth Promise Act, which is our top domestic priority. And she didn't stop there. She made sure that her two senators were aware of those three published pieces when she met in person with Senator Portman himself and with Senator Brown's staff. So developing these dialogues with Congress and the media to catalyze major peacebuilding progress is the MO of many volunteers on this call. So now let me tell them a little bit about you. Daniel Sullivan is the Director of Policy and Government Relations with an organization called United to End Genocide. Many of you have probably heard our president, Bob Baskin, talk about our partnership with the Prevention and Protection Working Group here in D.C., and United to End Genocide is one of our highly valued partners in that working group. So Dan manages the organization's conflict analysis and policy recommendations related to Sudan, Syria, Libya, Democratic Republic of Congo, and Burma, as well as the overall prevention of genocide and mass atrocities. Dan plays a leading role in outreach to the U.S. administration and Congress and coordination with international NGOs and civil society groups. And we are so thrilled to have him with us. Welcome, Dan.
Hi, thank you very much. Very happy to be here. And I missed the first couple of minutes of the call, so if I'm not sure if I missed anything important, or if I say something that doesn't make sense related to that, then just let me know. But so I'm happy to talk about the Genocide and Atrocities Prevention Act. And what I want to do is just say what is the Genocide and Atrocities Prevention Act, why does it matter, And then third, what can you do about it? What can activists do about it? But let me first start with a quick introduction that, you know, as was mentioned, I'm the Director of Policy and Government Relations at United to End Genocide, which was formed from a merger with Save Darfur Coalition and the Genocide Intervention Network. So it really came out of the whole Save Darfur movement, but now works to prevent and end genocide and mass atrocities wherever they're happening in the world. And just on a, you know, on a personal note of how I came into all of this, you know, I remember learning about the Holocaust and the lessons of and the cries of never again, and then shortly after that, seeing that Rwanda was happening. And there, I said, wow, there's a genocide happening today, and then really got more into this work and started studying it, and then Darfur happened, and go to today where I've had the opportunity to go to some of the camps of people who have been affected by this mass violence in Burma and Sudan and South Sudan, and really seen it up front. But in that, and you know, and you see Syria, and it can be a little bit overwhelming. But also over the recent years, I've seen a lot of progress. There's a lot more tools that are available, and a lot more awareness and desire to do something about genocide and mass atrocities. And that's where the Genocide and Atrocity Prevention Act comes in. One opportunity that I had was to work with former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright when she was the co-chair of the Genocide Protection Task Force. And if you've spent much time in D.C. or if you've followed what happened, you'll see a lot of reports come out. But this was one that was very encouraging because a lot of its recommendations have been taken on. There was a White House position focused on genocide and mass atrocities prevention. There were declarations from the highest levels, from the President of the United States, that preventing genocide and mass atrocities really is a top priority, a national priority, and a moral priority of the United States. There was an atrocities prevention board that was set up, which means that people at the highest levels on all different agencies and parts of the government have to come together on a regular basis to look at the world and where are the greatest threats to genocide and mass atrocities. That didn't exist before. There were one-off kind of, if something like Syria happened, there's an interagency group, but there wasn't this regular looking at the world and where can we see opportunities to prevent early on the worst crimes against humanity that can happen. That's kind of the backdrop to the Genocide and Atrocities Prevention Act, and the purpose of it is to maintain some of that progress that's been made and then to push further. So with that, what is the Genocide and Atrocities Prevention Act? There's four main things in there that I want to emphasize. One is training. So this would be legislation that would authorize more training for all of the State Department and USAID, foreign service officers, the people who are really on the front lines in the world, to look for the warning signs of genocide and mass atrocities. So that the earlier we know and see these warning signs, the better, and then we can implement early actions to prevent genocide and mass atrocities. And that's where the second point, flexible funding comes in. There are, in recent years, there's been a creation of a complex crisis fund. Now what that means is, you know, each year the Congress and the White House go through their budget process and lay out what's going to be allocated for the next year. But sometimes there's sudden crises that weren't foreseen that come out, and there's a need for some flexible funds, and particularly in the case where people are warning about an imminent genocide or mass atrocities, you want to have those funds to allow for programs that can help to avoid them, those situations getting escalating to genocide or mass atrocities. A third point, and I mentioned this earlier, was the Atrocities Prevention Board. This was set up in the last administration, but there's no guarantees that it will go beyond that. And there's been mixed reviews of what the Atrocities Prevention Board has done so far, but and it's tough because it was really launched right when Syria really broke out, and so a lot of people will point to Syria and say, well, look, it obviously didn't work. But that's a, you know, that's, Syria had already reached a point where it's the Atrocities Prevention Board is trying to get on the ground and identify the warning signs before it reaches something like Syria's level. And there are, and I'll talk about this in just a minute, there are some concrete examples of what the Atrocities Prevention Board has done successfully. But that's the third point. So you have the training, the flexible funding, the Atrocities Prevention Board. The Genocide and Atrocity Prevention Act would authorize the Atrocities Prevention Board and make it more permanent. And then the last point, which I think is a really important one, is that the Genocide and Atrocities Prevention Act would require that the Director of National Intelligence gives a briefing every year to the Congress about which countries are at the greatest dangers of genocide mass atrocities. There's already a yearly annual intelligence report in general that the Director of National Intelligence needs to make to Congress. Now there's a focus on countries that are at risk of genocide mass atrocities. And that's important not only because it gets the intelligence community involved for looking at these warning signs, but also because it gets Congress more involved and lets them know what's going on, and gives them a chance to ask the administration and the intelligence community questions about where in the world are there risks of genocide and mass atrocities. So that's what the Genocide and Atrocity Prevention Act is. Now, why does it matter? And I think there's three strong arguments, and if, as you all are thinking of speaking to members of Congress or speaking to others and making the case, I think these are and possibly writing letters to the editor and getting this out there, three strong arguments. One is the moral argument. I think this one's fairly obvious. We're living in a world where we have more refugees, 60 million plus than any time since World War II. The effects of genocide mass atrocities cause refugees. They tie into my second point, which is the national security argument, where preventing genocide mass atrocities is also a national security priority because of the knock-on effects of refugees, of feeding into violent extremism and instability across the world. So you have the moral argument that's fairly obvious. When the worst crimes are happening in anywhere in the world to the most vulnerable people, we have a responsibility to do what we can to try to help and prevent that and end it. Then you have the national security argument. And the third is an economic argument, where there's been studies done of how many millions of dollars it costs when crises break out. I'm thinking of South Sudan in particular. There was a recent study where just millions of dollars lost, both in terms of the economic potential that country had, but also for the international community, the amount of money that's spent on humanitarian aid and then development. So a lot of strong reasons why something like this matters. And let me just talk about a couple of concrete examples. You know, I mentioned the Atrocities Prevention Board and the Complex Crises Fund, where they have had a real impact. One of those is Jordan. The millions of people that have been displaced in Syria, where are they being displaced to? Most of them to neighboring countries. And one of those that is very fragile is Jordan. One of the camps is one of the largest cities now in Jordan of refugees. And just last week, they had their 5,000th birth in this camp that's only been around for a couple of years. But it's basically become its own city. So you can imagine the threats and the tensions that are boiling there, even as more people come into the camps to escape the attacks in Syria. So what the Complex Crises Fund has been able to do is to fund water management and conflict mitigation programs and to over 130 different communities. So that's been going on the ground. You can see some real concrete results. The other example I'll talk about is Burundi, where many of you may have seen in the news that over the past year, one of the strongest warning signs of genocide has come out of Burundi. And part of that is it's a neighbor of Rwanda, has a similar ethnic split between the Hutu and the Tutsi, though it's a little bit different of a history. But this is a part of the world, and this is a country in particular that has seen mass atrocities happen in the past. The Atrocities Prevention Board and others saw this very early on, that there were warning signs, and began programs. Now, there were atrocities did end up happening, but just looking at Rwanda, where 800,000 to a million people were killed, the scale of what could have happened had people not gotten in earlier could have been a lot worse. And when it did start getting worse, the U.S. actually had options. And this is something that has been played out and validated by the Special Envoy for the Great Lakes region in Africa. The U.S. Special Envoy has said this before Congress. Various ambassadors are saying they supporting the Atrocities Prevention Board and asking for help with the complex crises funds and the experts that that the Atrocities Prevention Board and efforts can provide. So this is there. It's not just about a new structure that's out there. Looking around the world, it's actually about putting people and resources on the ground to end and prevent genocide and mass atrocities. And so let me end it with just saying what can you do? This is hopefully I've convinced you all that this is a great idea. It has the moral argument, the national security argument, the economic argument. So what can be done? The first thing is. There are Peace Alliance and my organization, Unite to End Genocide, and others have petitions and online actions now that you can go to our website and send a message directly to your member of Congress to support this. And then a second thing is, as I mentioned, was letters to the editor. So really this is a really important point. If you write to your local newspaper, the people who are in Congress who can vote for this, who can support it, they do pay attention to that. Your voice really does matter. My boss is a former member of Congress from Maine, and he always tells me how when he was in office, first thing he'd do coming in to the office is ask, what's going on? Who's calling? What are people calling about? What's going on? And if he was out at a public meeting and someone raised their hand and said, hey, where are you on the Genocide and Atrocity Prevention Act, for example? If he doesn't know about it, the first thing he's going to do is go back to his staff and say, what is this? Let me know what's going on. And if people are seeing it in the newspapers and hearing it at public events, it can really make a difference. There's those of us who are pushing from within side in Washington, D.C., and we'll meet with the members of Congress, but it doesn't have the same impact as when you have the numbers who are there from within their states that can really push them. So let me end it right there. I'm happy to take questions and just want to emphasize again, this is really important and something that you all, your voices are very strong and very important for this. So thank you for the opportunity to talk to you about this.
Thanks so much, Dan. That was really, really comprehensive. I think this is going to be one of those calls. The recording will be available on our website, and I think this will be one that folks go back to over and over for a really solid primer on what this is and why it's important, folks, and what you can do about it. Folks that have a question are welcome to press 1 on your keypad, and that'll be the equivalent of raising your hand, and I'll call on somebody. So go ahead and press 1 on your keypad if you have a question. I see a hand going up, but I'm going to go ahead and take facilitator privilege and ask a quick question first. Dan, the bill is not that long. It's about 18 pages, and it includes a definition of peace building. Can you reflect on, is this unusual? Is it unique? Have we seen a federal legislation define peace building before? Is there anything special about this, or is it not such a new thing?
No, I think it is very unique. There may be some other legislation out there that has a definition. I haven't seen it, and certainly not on the level of attention that this does. I know that groups that that have been involved with this, there was a very very lengthy and debate about what definitions to put in there and around peace building in particular. So I think all of some of the leading thought leaders on people who are working on peace building, groups like Peace Alliance, have had a say on how that should best be put in. But yeah, I think that's a very unique and important point.
The definition sat quite well with me, I'll say, and I'd recommend that the reading of the bill. It reads pretty easily. It's straightforward and makes sense. You can always go to congress.gov and put in Genocide and Atrocities Prevention Act, and the bill number is on your action sheet. It's 2551 if you want to search for it, and you can get the whole text. How about a question from Nancy Merritt? Go ahead, Nancy. Your mic is open.
Okay. Well, thank you for your discussion. On the definition of peace building, by the way, the Department of Peace Building Bill H.R. 1111 does have a definition in that, in its language also. But what I was going to ask you is I'm from California. I see that Barbara Boxer is a co-sponsor, and I'm wondering if you have approached Dianne Feinstein and what kind of where she is at on that, on the bill.
Yeah, thank you. I have not, and Unite to End Genocide has not approached her. I know that there are several other groups that are working on this. I believe that, yes, she's been approached. I'm not sure. I'd have to check on where exactly she is.
Okay.
I would imagine, based on past work with her on Burma and other things, that this would be something to support. But then again, from my perspective, it's something that should be very easy for everyone to support.
And it might be in the bill, but I haven't read it. What would the cost be?
It does not lay out any specific costs. There is other legislation within the appropriations process that would lay out some numbers. But what this does is it authorizes that there would be funds. For example, for the Complex Crises Fund was up around was it 50 million, but it's gone down in recent years, and it's a constant battle to make sure that there is this kind of flexible funding. So what this bill does is just gets that first important point of authorizing that there should be funds specifically for these kinds of things.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Nancy. Again, if you have a question, feel free to press 1 on your keypad, and I'll see your hand go up and I'll call on you. I have another question. It's kind of a ballpark question, Dan. Do you have a sense of the likelihood in the current congressional climate of this bill moving? And do you have a sense of how fast, what kind of trajectory it might be on? Just to give us a little sense of perspective of what the chances look like right now for it, and would you hazard a guess at how fast it might move and what it's going to look like?
Sure. Well, I know that first of all, that it was it's a bipartisan introduction that Senator Cardin and Senator Tom Tillis co-sponsored. So that right there is a very important point. I know there was another Republican recently just came on, I think the number is now up to about 15. And again, you can go to the congress.gov and put in Genocide and Atrocity Prevention Act and get the latest, although I know that there's at least one more that hasn't been added yet. So I mean, it's off to a pretty good start. The ideas, what we are doing and other groups and I know Peace Alliance is working on is to really do a big push now and ahead of April, which will be Genocide Prevention and Awareness Month. So this is the time that it's been introduced, and there's this rolling push, and there've been a couple of pieces that have, there's been several pieces now coming out in various college newspapers, and we put up a piece on the Huffington Post. There's been in The Hill. So there's been sort of a rolling push for this that's really going to ramp up ahead of April and into and through April. And that's, I think, a really important moment to get the momentum going. The later we get into the year, the harder it's going to be because of it being an election year and the number of days that Congress is out. And as you know, sort of the bipartisan fighting goes on, even something like this can face challenges. But again, I emphasize again how much it really is a bipartisan or nonpartisan issue, and it does have a chance. It's a challenging environment, but like I said, right now the next month or two is their time to really push and keep momentum going.
Thank you. Awesome. So this is a great time to get letters published and to be talking with senators, especially. I see a few other hands have gone up, and we have time for one, maybe more than one question. Going up to Alaska, that's Lori and Jennifer. I don't know which one of you has a question.
We were wondering if we just wanted to clarify something that we heard about the Atrocities Prevention Board. I think I heard you say that it was set up by the last administration. So did you mean the Bush administration?
No, I mean this latest administration. So it was the Atrocities
sometimes
Prevention Board was sent.
Yeah, I sometimes have a hard time with our Congress people that don't really want to support anything that the Obama administration has put into place. So it's kind of
right. And you know, I think that the bill in the language, it does a really good job of in the introduction, showing how this has been a bipartisan concern, how many different presidents have talked about the importance of prevention, and how this is, this is, again, the Genocide and Prevention Task Force report that I mentioned. It wasn't just Secretary Albright, it was also Secretary of State former Secretary of Defense William Cohen. That was really, there were people from both sides of the aisle. So I think, emphasizing those kinds of things can really help to show that this isn't just about the Atrocities Prevention Board, and it's not just about that being a legacy of President Obama. It's much larger than that. This is a long time effort that various administrations have looked at the need to address genocide and mass atrocities. And since you're from Alaska, I just wanted to mention as well that the other Republican who just came on that we're hearing or should be coming on very soon is Lisa Murkowski. So keep an eye out. Keep an eye out. If it doesn't happen, then please push because it sounds like she's very close. If it does happen, then please also follow up and thank her.
Right, because that's because Jennifer and I went to see her in Washington, D.C. recently.
Oh, great, great. Yeah, well, that's a perfect example of why that's so important.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Laurie and Jennifer. So other hands have gone up, but I'm going to be disciplined because we've got such a packed schedule as usual. And I'm sure that if you have specific questions for Dan, you can reach out to him through United to End Genocide and go ahead and ask. Or if we can channel questions to us, we'll be happy to hear what's on your mind and discuss with you. Dan, I want to thank you again so much for joining us here tonight. It's been really valuable and worthwhile, and it's a pleasure to cooperate with you.
Yeah, well, it was a pleasure to talk with all of you, and good luck with all your efforts.
Thank you. Same to you. Okay, and of course you're welcome to stick with us for the rest of the call, but if you have other places to go and things to do, we understand.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Ken, for the opportunity. Bye.
Pleasure. Okay, wonderful, wonderful. So next on our agenda, we have a couple of announcements, and really pretty briefly. One is that the Teaching Peace in Schools course, the virtual course that many of you will have heard of, is ongoing for another 5 weekly sessions. And it's been a great success. More than 230 people have registered and attended this 10-part course. So we're thrilled with the participation, and we're already in the early planning stages to consider future similar offerings. And I want to let you know, if you're interested in this current series, even though there's several sessions already done, there's still time to register and start attending. And once you register, you'll receive recordings of all the sessions that you've missed so far. So you can register from our Peace Alliance homepage, and there's plenty of detailed information about teaching peace in schools, about bringing restorative practices and social and emotional learning and empathetic communication into your school district, into your county and city, and hearing from real guiding faculty in the field about how this works and how it can be done. Scholarships are still available, so please contact me, Dan, at peacealliance.org, if you'd like to discuss a scholarship. Next, a quick once over the stats for February, and these stats represent in a numerical form what we consider some highly leveraged accomplishments towards our shared goals. That's part of why we share them. If you think we missed something that you or your comrades did in the field last month, please email me or Lori about it, and it's lori@peacealliance.org, L-O-R-I, because we'd love to know what you're up to. So I'll just share the year-to-date achievements, and I'll add how many of those were in the past month. So far, since January 1st, we've had 4 letters to the editor published, 3 op-eds published, and one of those was this past month, 4 coalition-building meetings, and one of those also was this past month. We've had 2 public presentations, and so far, no radio or TV interviews or articles or editorials or tabling or in-person congressional meetings. Now, there were also some other gains this past month that were a little tougher to categorize, and I think you'll hear about some of those from our grassroots victory sharers. So let's just go ahead right into the sharing of grassroots victories. There are 2 really powerful stories that I want to welcome tonight. First, I want to hear from Cheryl Kaplan in Gainesville, Florida, who has been, as some of you are, I'm sure, aware, cultivating relationships with Congress and her local media really masterfully over the past 2 years, and her work has been bearing some really pretty serious fruit. Are you ready, Cheryl?
Yes, I'm ready.
Okay, tell us about it.
Okay. There's lots of little pieces that I need to share and give everybody a little bit of history so that I can bring you up to date on what's happened. I regularly watch C-SPAN, and one time I saw a special order, which is a conversation on the floor of Congress about some legislation with both parties. And I got the idea that Bobby Scott could do that for the YPA, which is the Youth Promise Act. It turned, I called Dan, I called you and said, can I do this? And you said, well, it's very rare, but citizens can do it, get it started, and it's really not unheard of. So I decided to talk with Congressman Ted Yoho, who was a Tea Party Republican. And he and I have a very nice relationship. So I went to see him with Hart Phoenix. Hart Phoenix is her program, the River Phoenix Center for Peace Building, is doing a wonderful program here in Gainesville and Alachua County. It's called the Police Youth Dialogue, and all of our different sheriff's offices and police departments get together with teenagers who are in trouble. Hart asked me why I wanted her to come along, because I could have done this by myself, and I told her that I wanted her to talk about what's happening locally, and I wanted to talk about what's happening nationally. So when we started talking, it was very, very cordial. We both know Congressman Yoho. He knows us. And she told him about what she was doing, and he got very excited and asked if he could come and observe. And so just the other day I talked to her, and she said that, yes, he had come, and everyone was very excited. They took pictures, and they just had a wonderful time meeting the congressman. I talked to him about doing a special order, and I was willing even to try and, you know, call somebody and say, let's do this. But he was got very excited about it and said that in April is Child Abuse Month, and he wanted to do something. He wanted to do it in April. And he would get in touch with Congressman Bobby Scott, who's a Democrat. He's the person who is the main sponsor of this. So let me move up to a month later. First of all, I went to a luncheon, and Congressman Yoho gave me his cell phone number. And I promised him I wouldn't abuse it. But there was an article in the paper saying that he was going to have a town hall meeting. And I sent him a note, and I said, I'm coming. I'll see you at the meeting. I'm coming to the meeting. And it started a whole conversation through Messenger with him. And he told me that he's very excited because he's working on doing this special order with Bobby Scott. As a matter of fact, he asked me to ask people from the Peace, volunteers from the Peace Alliance, for names of people that he can get in touch with. I think probably he's mostly friends with Republicans, and I don't think it matters whose name you give me, but if it's a Republican, that's even better, because I think we have a lot more Democrats who are co-sponsoring this piece of legislation than we do have Republicans. So
let me jump in, Cheryl, just to underline that.
Okay.
So thank you. Congressman Ted Yoho is asking Cheryl basically what other Republican members of Congress throughout the country may have been hearing from their people about this. You know, so if you are anywhere in the country and you've been having some kind of dialogue with your member of Congress's office, especially if it's a Republican, about the Youth Promise Act, then please let us know about that so we make sure to include that person's name in a list to Congressman Yoho that he has asked for. So this is a great opportunity. So you can contact me with that, and I'll pass it along to Cheryl with pleasure. So dan@peacealliance.org. If you have a conversation with your member of Congress and you think they're moving in this direction, whether they're a Democrat or a Republican, but especially if they're a Republican, Congressman Yoho is ready to get on the phone with them and call them to the floor of the House to talk about this.
Yes, he's very excited about this, and I want to hold on to that excitement. When he had his town hall meeting, he had many of his legislative aides there, including his legislative aide from D.C., who I have met and have gotten to be friendly with, so that was even better. We got to sit down and talk about what the goal is, and she is on the same page as we are. So the next part of this is that is why I wrote a letter to the editor. I wrote an op-ed, and it got published online and in print. I'm teaching a parenting class to parents of kids who are having problems in elementary school. They're starting that young. And my boss said to me one day, so I heard that you and Ted Yoho are BFF, which got my goat. We're not BFF. And I got really energized to write a letter about what it means to be working with somebody who you're not on the same page with, and your politics are totally different. So I wrote this op-ed, and I read it to my husband, who said to me, it sounds like you're supporting Ted Yoho. So, of course, that made me really upset. So I called my editor, Nathan Crabb, and I read it to him, and he said, "Oh, that's wonderful. Let's put that in the paper." So I don't know if you've read it. It's online at Gainesville.com. What's Tuesday? I don't know the date of it, but maybe Dan can send it out. Anyway,
yeah, we'd be happy to. We'll send that to everybody on this call. It really is. It's a beautiful example. When Andy, Cheryl's husband, says that it sounds like she's supporting Congressman Yoho, my comment to Cheryl was, I think she is supporting him as a fellow human being, saying that she appreciates these things that he's doing. It doesn't necessarily mean that she's going to vote for him, but they found some common ground, and there's some cooperation happening, and that's a really great achievement. So, yeah, we'll send that link to that article to everybody who's on this call so you can take a look at it.
Okay, thank you. In the article, I talked about the help that he's giving to the Peace Alliance, helping to get a wider audience and a larger conversation about the YPA going in Congress. And I said that we have agreed to disagree. I'm a Democrat. He's a Republican. It was right in that article. And but we had found common ground. So the surprise for me was that several people came up to me and said that they saw the article, and they were disappointed because they thought that I was supporting Congressman Yoho. And I said, you know, I am supporting him because he's helping us with the YPA. I'm not supporting him on all the other issues. He knows that I'm not a supporter of his politics. And, you know, putting in there, we agreed to disagree. I thought that that was a good thing to put in there. I think the disappointment that I've been feeling is that people don't think that they can work with someone who's different from them and get anything done. And he and I are, you know, miles apart on our politics, but we have found common ground in the YPA. And so I'm happy to support him for helping to support us. And I encourage all of you to not turn away from someone who says something that you totally disagree with, but they're willing to help you in another area. So that's what happened. I'm hoping that in April we will have a special order on the floor, and they told me that they would send me, that I would be able to come and be in the audience. And the other part of it was that he's not a real popular man around here in Gainesville. We're very liberal around here with the University of Florida. But he also has another wonderful thing to talk about, and that is what the River Phoenix Center is doing that could be used all over the United States. So when I talked to my editor, he said, he's a nice man. You know, we're not talking about, he's not a nasty man. He just has different politics than we do. And we finally found some common ground. And I'm hoping that other people will begin to understand that. But I decided I just can't worry about it. That's it.
Beautiful. So beautiful.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Amazing. It's a great story. Thank you so much. It's like a blueprint. I would love to see this happen all over the place, but it's a great, great piece of the puzzle. Next, for something completely different but also amazing, let's go all the way to the other coast, where for the fourth or fifth time now, a dedicated group of volunteers has attended the California Democratic Party's convention, the state convention, the Democratic Party, and they have really helped peace-building prospects to take root and flourish through that vehicle. So I'd like to hear about it from another shining light in this movement, our friend Nancy Merritt in the Bay Area. Nancy, are you ready to talk about it?
I am. First, I wanted to say thank you to Cheryl and to let you know that we've talked to all 52 members of Congress from California about the YPA, including all 13. The few 13 Republicans that we let get elected somehow. So I don't know if you want to add them to the list, but anyway, we have spoken with them. As Dan said, we've been working with California Democratic Party in an organized sort of group way for, this is the 16th time now in the last few years that we've attended all statewide meetings, including executive board meetings and conventions, and have built some really, really good relationships with the party and gotten support from them on all kinds of levels. The convention this time, which was just a couple of weeks ago, was focused on the California Democratic Party 2016 platform and then on endorsing candidates. So our focus, of course, was to contribute to the platform and to interact with as many candidates as we could to spread the word about peace building and to talk with them about how they're going to support peace building when they're elected or reelected into Congress. Our group is from all over the state of California, and we have a wonderful group of sort of constant volunteers and then others who help us at these party meetings. And then we have others in the state who are taking up, I'll tell you in a minute, our follow-up, but who are helping us with follow-up on what we're doing. We connected probably with, well, there were hundreds of delegates. There were over 2,000 delegates, and we connected with a lot of them. First we went to the platform committee, and that whole process started in the fall, and we submitted peace building language to most of the planks in the platform. A lot of our language was accepted or kind of adapted and integrated into the platform. So when they came out with the first draft in January, we were very happy. There was one thing, I guess you'd say, one portion of one bill, one plank that we decided to challenge at the hearing, and it was inclusion of the word fight. California Democrats will fight for, and it had a whole list of things. And so we thought, well, we wanted to just raise awareness that we could maybe improve our language. And, you know, we knew probably we wouldn't win that fight, but just to raise awareness about that. So that was one thing we did. We talked with most of the key people who are running for office to let them know about peace building, restorative justice, Department of Peace Building, Youth Promise Act, and got some promises from some people who are running and likely will win their congressional seats. We talked with Kamala Harris's people. She's probably going to win the seat that Senator Boxer is retiring from. We talked with even other levels of people in the state government, including the person who will probably win the attorney general race. And he's very, very interested, and so we can totally count on him on any restorative justice ideas. So that was it. One of the main twists to this convention that hasn't happened before is Joe Biden spoke, And because Joe Biden spoke, it created a whole security nightmare. So on Saturday, when we normally get a lot of traffic at our booth, most people were waiting in lines to get through security. Some people waited as long as 2 or 3 hours, and they confiscated people's water bottles and their fruit and all that kind of stuff. And then once Joe Biden arrived at the convention, they locked it down so you couldn't get in or out. So wherever you were at that point, you couldn't get in or out. So that was frustrating to a lot of people. But he gave a wonderful speech, a very consensus-building speech, and talked about ways that if people want to accomplish things, he had some very concrete ways about how the money's there if we have the political will to ask and accomplish that. So that was kind of the main gist of what we did. I maybe would just tell you a couple of the things that we got into the party platform. Language that I think a lot of you will agree with. One was in the children and young adults and their families, promote policies and support agencies that are responsible for providing mental health services, domestic violence prevention, gang prevention, anti-bullying programs, substance abuse prevention, parenting skills, and social services. Encouraging foster youth to complete high school. In the criminal justice area, we got some restorative language in there. In the education plank, we got also supporting restorative policies and practices that eliminate the school-to-prison pipeline, language like that. And then in the world, we got it into several other planks, but I'm not going to read all of them. In the final plank of world peace and international relations, there's a new language that we were part of, which was support the dignified treatment of refugees, no matter their race, religion, or country of origin. So that's some of what we did, and I really want to thank everybody in the state of California for their help. With the signatures, we got 250 signatures for letters we've now sent out to members, California members of Congress, and folks in San Diego are helping us with Susan Davis, Joanne Gaines, and folks in Los Angeles who weren't there but are helping us with getting Ted Lieu on board on the Department of Peace building, and several people throughout the state. So that's where we're at. So thank you, California.
Thank you, California, and thank you, Nancy. This is such a big and impressive project. I wonder, Nancy, would you be willing to share your email address if folks have questions about, like, how did you do this and what you open to guidance? Is there a way they can get in touch with you, or would you rather they do that through me? Do you have a preference?
The easiest probably would be nancy@peacealliance.org.
Okay.
Yeah, and I will be submitting an article to the that hopefully will get put on our website, so it'll have more details. And we encourage any of you to go to your to participate in your state level conventions or caucuses or whatever, because you really can impact policy, and it makes a real difference in building those relationships, and asking and holding candidates to letting them know about what we want, and they remember it. Whether they finally do it or not, or when they do it, is another question, but it's very important. So I encourage you all to do that.
Thank you. Great stuff. I feel lucky to be part of this community that's taking these amazing kinds of actions. And people are working at various levels. I know not everybody is doing the same thing. But it's really wonderful to be part of such a diverse and caring, connected community. Now it's time to review the monthly action sheet. We've just got about 5 minutes left to look at what the action is for March. So if you don't already have it, you can go to our homepage on peacealliance.org, and on the right side there's a red ribbon. It says monthly actions, and on that page you can download the action sheet. So I'm going to ask for a couple of volunteers in these couple of minutes, and Lori has excitedly agreed to be my default volunteer if no hands go up for the first 8.5 seconds or so. We'd love to hear some other voices, but we're also always glad to hear Lori's too. What I'd first like to ask is, let me put down the current hands. Is somebody willing to tell me, just in a nutshell, what this action is about, and then maybe read a couple of sections of the action sheet? So please press 1 on your keypad if you're willing to just tell me what the action is and then read aloud a couple of sections of this action sheet. Anybody feel like raising your voice and putting it out there? Oh, there's one. Great. Thank you, Deborah. Okay. Hi, Deborah. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can hear you fine.
Okay, great. I hear you too. So in a nutshell, what is this March action about? Do you remember?
Yes, yeah, just writing a letter to the editor promoting the Genocide and Atrocity Prevention Act. And basically that. And then, of course, you know, doing the EPIC format. And then it's got all the overview of the Prevention Act. And I think you also attached, or on there, you can go to the website for the full thing. But this gives you like 4 different areas is basically authorizing. And basically it's authorizing. They're wanting to authorize it because currently it exists because of executive orders, which I thought that was pretty interesting. So it is existing, but we're just wanting to get Congress to be established by Congress to get their funding to be continued and be far more secure. So apparently, I mean, the way I look at it, it currently exists.
Part of it does.
Is that correct?
Part of it does.
Yes, two.
It authorizes. Two parts of it. It authorizes the Atrocities Prevention Board, and it authorizes the Complex Crises Fund. So you're right. Both of those things currently exist by executive order. So this bill would make them exist by a law that was passed by Congress. So it makes them more sustainable, more long-lasting. Would you read from the top, actually, the first few paragraphs, just to kind of get that into that ballpark.
Okay, where it says with a worldwide refugee crisis.
Perfect, right there. That's great.
Okay, and violent inter-religious, inter-ethnic, and international conflict raging around the globe. Let's emphasize getting ahead of the curve. This bill would help prevent and transform such conflicts at the earliest stages. Every paper has its own criteria regarding length and other considerations. For structure, please consider the EPIC format below with some contact ideas.
That's perfect. And so I think from listening to Dan and going over this again, folks probably have a pretty good idea about what this bill is about. And the EPIC format that you mentioned down below, what's the first part of EPIC? EPIC is an acronym, EPIC. What's the E for?
Engage.
Hmm. So what does it say under that?
Oh, to the editors, find out the reference of an article about current foreign conflict, atrocity, or diplomatic effort, and your emotional reaction to it, perhaps grief, sadness, or anger, or yearning for more effective resources.
Okay, perfect.
Problem.
That's engaging, is saying, how do I feel about this? And this is a suggested format that's just sort of, you know, time-tested. And then the next section is the problem, what do you think is at issue. But I'd like to do a quick exercise. I know it's the top of the hour, but I want to take us about 3 minutes over, if you would. Let me put hands down because I'm gonna ask for another volunteer. Thank you, Deborah. That was great. And if you want to volunteer for this next section, you can do that too. But I'd like another volunteer to do a quick exercise. If you've got a newspaper handy, either online or a hard copy, and you're willing to do a quick exercise in responding to an article in your paper, just to show what that might look like. Can I have a volunteer for that? Let me go ahead and pull the Lori card. Lori, you ready?
I am, Dan. I found an article that's called Turkey Snarls EU Refugee Response with Demands.
So Turkey snarls EU refugee response with demands. So here's a conflict between Turkey and the European Union about where the refugees are going to go. And so, of course, I encourage you to read the entire article that you're going to respond to, but just based on that headline, just based on what you think this is about, Lori, do you have a sense of how you might start your letter if you were going to engage about this issue? What would be the beginning of your letter?
I think I would just say when I read the article and state the title, I just felt a great weariness overcome me of learning of these refugees with no place to go. You know, something like that, because that's what I feel. This weight, this burden.
And I really get that. You're sharing your personal reaction, and that's what helps people to connect. When we say engage, it's really tangible. You felt weary, and I get it. You know, this refugee crisis is makes you sad and tired. And then you would go on to talk about how there are ways to get ahead of the next crisis, that there are proven peace-building tools, and you would bring in the solutions. And you can use that EPIC format for guidance on how that letter might look. So that's a great example. And I don't want to keep you too far past the end of the hour, so I'll leave the rest to your imagination. For folks that have a newspaper handy or can get one online, I really encourage you to find an article that talks in some measure about some current issue with foreign conflict or refugees or diplomatic efforts. How do you react to it? And look up, there's specific instructions on this action sheet about what you want to do to make sure you have the word length correct, and you know where do you submit your piece. So paint by numbers. And if you have any questions, Lori and I are happy to engage with you about it. We'll look at drafts. We'll give you feedback. Again, Dan at peacealliance.org and Lori at peacealliance.org. So I encourage you to go ahead and think about getting something written, make a plan sometime this week. And I have a closing quote by Dr. Martin Luther King, which I'd like to share. He said, "We must evolve for all human conflict a method which rejects revenge, aggression, and retaliation. The foundation of such a method is love." I'll say it again. We must evolve for all human conflict a method which rejects revenge, aggression, and retaliation. The foundation of such a method is love. So I wish for all of you to feel a deep abundance of love right now, and I want to thank you so much for joining us. Again, feel free to send drafts or questions to me or Lori, Dan or Lori at peacealliance.org, and thank you so much for allowing us to support you in this powerful work of peace building. And all your mics are open now if you want to say good night, and I hope you have a wonderful month, and we'll be in touch.